Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Rescue 911, Tales from a First Responder, by Michael Morse, narrated by Danny Campbell. Forward. Back in 2009, I discovered a blog called Rescuing Providence. The author, a lieutenant with the Providence, Rhode Island Fire Department, had a gift for capturing the drudgery, drama, humor, and pathos of EMS, and I soon bought the book of the same name, a chronicle of one 34-hour shift on Rescue 1 in Providence. I finished it in one sitting, immediately realizing that, in comparison, I still had much growing to do as a writer and storyteller. Thus was my introduction to Michael Morse. In the genre of EMS memoirs and fiction, there are two types of authors: paramedics who write about what they do, and riders who work on an ambulance as their full-time jobs. Michael Morse is that second type. His prose is spare, often terse, but wonderfully descriptive. In a genre where most offerings are the EMS equivalent of a Faulkner novel, long and rambling, but without the elegance of craft, Michael Morse is a Hemingway. He is able to wring more humanity out of a short, declarative sentence than most of us can in a paragraph, myself included. Michael Morse is simply a better storyteller than I. Like Rescuing Providence before it, Rescue 911, Tales from a First Responder, chronicles Morse's days at the Providence Fire Department in a series of short vignettes, each capturing something memorable about the encounter. He captures every element of a career spent as a caregiver: the fear, the drudgery, the system abuse, the boring routine, the triumph and the tragedy, the sublime and the silly. He offers a stark and unsparing glimpse into the life of an EMT, with none of the "look at me, I'm a hero" melodrama so common in EMS memoirs. Instead, Michael Morse pens a love song to our profession by simply showing you what EMS is, without glamour. He affords you a window into humanity, raw and real, and trusts the audience to make the judgment as to whether the profession and those practicing it acquits themselves with honor. In this book, I think you'll see that they do. Kelly Grayson, author of En Route, a paramedic's stories of life, death, and everything in between. Introduction. Welcome to Providence, my training officer said to us, 64 trainees all about to begin a career in the fire service. Some of us had experience, some did not. We were told to forget everything we knew or thought we knew about the vocation we had chosen, because now we were going to learn things the Providence way. Most of us made it out of the academy, and many of those who did made it another 20 years and retired. Some were injured and had to leave before they were ready. Some of us are still working 25 years later. New faces are introduced every few years. Trainees become probies, probies become firefighters, firefighters become officers, and some of those become chiefs. One thing remains certain: every person who raises their right hand and takes the oath of office is from that day forward until the day they die a firefighter. While never forgetting who we were before, we know that we will never be the same. It is an honor to belong in the fire service, not because of who we are as individuals, rather because of those who came before us and wore the uniform well, worked, lived, and sometimes died doing the job. At the end of the day, when the smoke is cleared and the fires are out, and we make it home, we can rest easy, knowing that others like us are on duty, keeping things safe. We know this because we live it, every second of every day, for life. Magic. We're driving down Angel Street at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Perfect late summer day. Nice iced coffee in the cup holder. Pretty girls in summer dresses everywhere, and no runs coming our way. We approach the Rhode Island School of Design just as a bus is leaving, full of kids going home from a week-long summer program. The bus is packed, and it slowly pulls away from the school, ready to bring the kids back to wherever it is they came from. I hear shouting behind us, a happy sound, kids whooping it up. Dozens run past us, flanking the bus, jumping up and down, waving, smiling from ear to ear. The kids in the bus respond in kind, and it is sweet mayhem for a minute. Then the bus moves down the hill toward the city. The spontaneous honor guard follows, escorting the bus, shouting, waving, keeping pace for a while before the machinery outpaces the humans and distance spreads. The guard keeps running. They catch the bus at the next light. More euphoria ensues. The joyous cacophony contagious as pedestrians and drivers and tired EMTs are caught up in the display of affection and sheer unblemished happiness. A few join in and honk their horns or raise their hands in the air or chirp their siren, and the bus moves again, finally outdistancing the pack. The tired runners slow down, then stop, then turn around and head back up the hill and wait for their bus to take them back to wherever it is they came from. New friendships formed, and an experience that will last them a lifetime. I'm stunned at the effect this little moment of magic has on me. The drowned 2-year-old, the dead 25-year-old, the beaten teen, the hopeless and lost all recede into the back of my mind, and light shines through. It is a moment of grace delivered at just the right time, and I never saw it coming, or knew how badly I needed it. A call came in. We had to respond. And my voice sounded a little different when I answered the radio and wiped my eyes, knowing that no matter what, things will be all right. Numbers. Wind, gritty with sand lifted from the pavement, pecked at the skin on our faces, bitter, painful, and relentless. Come with me, it's freezing out here, I said to the woman. She stared into the wind, unblinking. Tears rolled down her face. She made no effort to wipe them away. Come on now, we can't leave you here, I said, taking hold of her coat. It was a nice one, hardly used. There's cats in the meadow, she said, and followed me. Are there? And what kind of cats might they be? She made eye contact then and continued. The bisque is frozen. Better get on with it then. You can't eat frozen bisque. The pencils need sharpening. I hate writing with dull pencils. Do you write often? If the laundry is done in time, we'll go to the park. Is the park near your home? Nothing then. But at least we were inside the rescue, heading toward Rhode Island Hospital and safety. She had been wandering around downtown for hours, and nobody paid her any attention. The city is full of strange characters. She mixed in with the rest and appeared to belong. Where do you live? Nothing. I bought a lottery ticket yesterday. 4235342. She looked up and again made eye contact. 4762343. She stayed interested. 9428725. She continued staring, but spoke. 2372983. 2372983. 2372983. I wrote the number down. When we pulled into the rescue bay at the hospital, I used the truck phone and dialed the number. It hadn't rung once when a frantic voice picked up. Hello? This is Lieutenant Morse with the Providence Fire Department. Oh my God, is she okay? I have a woman here, mid-60s, nicely dressed and appears lost. Where are you? Rhode Island Hospital. Where? Rhode Island Hospital. Is her name Ruth? I looked at the woman who was gone again. Ruth. She didn't budge or respond. I don't know, she has no ID, but is wearing a black velvet coat with fur trim on the collar. That's her. Thank you so much. We'll be there as soon as we can. It's an hour drive from Massachusetts. Massachusetts? She likes buses. An hour later, Ruth was reunited with her daughter, son-in-law, 5 of 6 kids, and a few other people. She had been missing for 16 hours. She had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's just this year. I have no idea what possessed me to start running off numbers. I guess I figured something in her mind might click. I've done a lot of things over the last 20 years, but that call was one of the most gratifying moments of my career. The family treated me like a hero and asked again and again how I got her to come up with the phone number. Truth is, I just got lucky. A woman suffering from dementia was found dead in a ditch in Newport last week. She wandered off. Before she was found, I heard a press release saying she liked to sit on public benches. I looked, but never saw her. What's the worst that could happen? I need a shower. Think I have time? What's the worst that could happen? I answered. Ed was working overtime and wanted a fresh start to the day. I was filling in for a rescue officer who was off on an injury. It was my first experience in charge of a fire department vehicle. Rescue 3 is quartered at the Branch Avenue Fire Station. It is a workhorse, 5,000 runs annually, the norm. All of Providence's advanced life support vehicles are workhorses, the call volume dramatically increasing as the years progress. Keep your radio on in case we get a call, I said as the door to the shower room closed. This should have been my first day back on Engine 9 after a 6-month detail to the rescue division. I enjoyed my time on Rescue 1, learned a lot and considered going back eventually, but I missed the camaraderie at the fire station, and of course, the firefighting. Providence rescues still respond to fires, but for the most part stay outside and tend to the wounded. I was looking forward to the old routine, the discussion around the coffee pot, the housework, polishing brass, checking the trucks, rechecking the trucks, making lunch, and, with any luck, fighting a little of the red devil. I didn't get a chance to walk in the door of the Brook Street Fire Station. "Welcome back, Morse. You're going to Rescue 3, in charge," said Tim, my truck mate from Engine 9, from the second-floor kitchen window. "See you tomorrow," he said, laughing, and shut the window so as not to let the cool air from the air conditioner out. I didn't take it personally. I knew Tim was looking forward to my return. We got along pretty well. I would just have to wait another day. I knew there was a possibility of being sent back to the rescue, but I didn't think it would happen so fast. The division is in desperate need of bodies. Not many firefighters are willing to be permanently assigned to the little white truck when the big red one is available. I put my gear back in the wagon and started toward the Branch Avenue Fire Barn and Rescue 3. The shower water must not have had a chance to get hot when the bell tipped. Rescue 3 and Engine 2, respond to I-95 North for an accident involving a school bus. Great. Rescue 3, responding. I heard Engine 2 roar out of the station. 30 seconds later, Ed appeared from the shower, soaking wet and getting dressed while walking toward the stairs. "What's the worst that can happen?" he said, shaking his head. "I should know better," I responded as the overhead door let the warm summer air into the bay. There are certain things that should never be uttered when on the clock. It's quiet. Things are so peaceful. What's the worst that could happen? Engine 2 to fire alarm. We have a school bus into a tractor trailer. Heavy damage to the school bus. We'll keep you informed. Here we go, I said to Ed as we sped toward the incident. Engine 2 to fire alarm. Advise rescue we have a pediatric trauma code. Expedite. The school bus driver drifted from her lane of travel at just the wrong time. A flatbed truck had stopped in the breakdown lane. The bus slammed into it, first smashing the windshield glass, then tearing into the passenger compartment, ripping the metal like a tin can. The baby didn't have a chance. She was in an infant seat at the door when the back of the flatbed crashed into the passenger compartment. We approached from the south. The roof of the bus was torn off the body 3/4 down the passenger side. I saw another Providence rescue just ahead of the bus. Brian took a bloody, still infant away from a woman who had stopped to help and started CPR. The mind has a way of slowing things down during crisis. In what seemed slow motion, Ed pulled Rescue 3 past the wreckage while I assessed the situation from the officer's seat. I fully expected mangled bodies of school kids inside the bus. The bus appeared empty when I looked through the shattered windows. The truck stopped. I stepped out and approached the wreckage, not really prepared for what lay inside, but forging ahead anyway. The driver of the bus sat slumped over the wheel, trapped. Another woman was trapped in the seat behind the driver. I forced myself to look down the narrow corridor for more victims. There were none. The bus had finished its morning route and was headed back to the garage. Special hazards arrived on scene and began extrication procedures. The state police blocked the highway while we worked. I watched the firefighters work like madmen during the extrication. I felt helpless standing on the highway, waiting. 15 minutes into the operation, the infant's mother was freed from her temporary prison. We lifted her out, using the freshly opened roof of the bus as an extrication route. She was unconscious, in shock, and had deformities to her extremities. We got her into the rescue and rolled toward Rhode Island Hospital, the area's Level 1 trauma center, about 10 minutes away. She lived. Her baby did not. What's the worst thing that could happen? Don't ask. And so began the second part of my career in the fire service. I'm still a firefighter. Once a person experiences that life, it never leaves. It's in your blood. For now, I spend my time on the rescue, EMS, a second calling. I got off to a rough start, and the road hasn't gotten much easier to travel. But for all the pain, lost sleep, and time away from my family, I can't imagine doing anything else. Heartbeat. The kid was alive when Engine 3 arrived, but died within minutes. Engine 3 to fire alarm, 11-year-old male, code 99. Rescue 1 received. I put the mic down and put on the gloves. My new partner Adam picked up the pace, instinctively knowing this was the real thing. We arrived on scene 30 seconds later, entered the home, and saw the CPR in progress. He was breathing when we got here, then he stopped and went pulseless. We put him on a backboard, continued CPR, picked up our equipment and patient, and carried him out of his home through a snow squall and into the rescue. His mother sat in the front, peering back as we worked. The monitor showed asystole, no shock advised. Joe worked like a madman trying to find a vein, while Donna and Adam did CPR. "What medical condition does he have?" I asked his mother, trying to keep my voice steady. "A neurological disorder that causes seizures. He was at the doctor's today for trouble breathing." She sounded calm. I think she was in shock. Joe found a good vein and sank the IV. "Go," I said to Ray, a new guy who was in the driver's seat. He sped toward Hasbro while we continued to work. One round of epi, pulseless. We tried an atropine, nothing. I attempted to tube him. The potholes made it difficult. I failed, then picked up the phone. "Rescue 1 to Hasbro. I've got an asystolic 11-year-old male. CPR in progress. IV established. ETA 2 minutes. The doctor on the other end of the phone asked a few questions. I gave the answers best I could, then hung up the phone. Another round of epi was ineffective. We brought him into the ER and transferred care to the medical team that had gathered. I gave the story and stood back, watching them work. 5 minutes passed. More epi, atropine, then sodium bicarb. I gave up hope. The room was a flurry of activity, noisy, a little chaotic. I saw the boy's parents outside the door, the mom now crying, stunned, the father now in shock. "We've got a pulse." The room went still. Sure enough, a rhythm appeared on the monitor, sinus tach. A few minutes later, I saw my patient open his eyes and look around the room. It's kind of strange what happened next. I was fully prepared for him to die. Whatever it is we have inside us making it possible to do this job was in full operation. I didn't feel anything, not sadness, despair, or frustration. I knew we did our job, and the outcome was out of our hands. I was at peace with that. Whatever it is that allows us to do this job disappeared as soon as I heard he had a pulse. When I saw him open his eyes, my own eyes filled with tears. It was strange. but I'll take it over emptiness any day. It's good to know I still have a heart. Reprinted with permission from EMS World. Wounded. The early morning sun had yet to break the horizon as we approached the two-family home in the heart of South Providence. Places like this are everywhere in the neighborhoods. Well-kept multi-family homes, some a little dated, others freshly painted with ornate metal gates adorning the driveways. There was no gate here, just an old Ford parked next to the house with a wounded combat veteran license plate on the back. A trend has resurfaced in this neighborhood. Somebody buys a two- or three-family home. Mom and Pop live on the ground floor. The kids who own the place occupy the second, and, if available, the third apartment is rented, sometimes to another family member to help foot the bill. My own family started out like this. It actually sounds kind of nice. Absentee landlords still exploit the poor folks who settle here, their homes obviously lacking the TLC needed to maintain the old places. I walked into the home. The old folks lived on the first floor. It looked like they had lived there for decades. Slumped in a kitchen chair was our patient, an 85-year-old veteran named Joe. Engine 11 had arrived first. An IV was already established, vital signs taken, and high-flow oxygen being delivered through a non-rebreather. Joe had tried to take a sip of his morning coffee, felt sudden weakness, and spilled it all over his crisp, white T-shirt. There was obvious facial droop and no strength on his left side when he squeezed my hands. His wife of 50 years stood by, nervously wiping the spilled coffee from the green linoleum floor. "He goes to the VA," she said. As the guys from the 11 and Adam helped Joe into the stair chair, having to strap him tight so he wouldn't tip to the left, I took his wife to the side. I hated doing it. "When did you notice something different?" I asked.
"Right before I called you, about 10 minutes ago. He was fine, drinking his coffee like he does every day. Then he dropped it and couldn't tell me what was wrong."
"I think Joe is having a stroke," I said as gently and quickly as I could. "If we get him to the proper facility, the damage can be stopped. We can help him, but the VA isn't the best place for something like this." She started to argue, insurance reasons maybe, familiarity more likely, but saw the urgency in my gaze and relented.
"I'll stay here and clean up," she replied, nervously wiping the kitchen table where the coffee-stained paper sat, open to the sports section.
In the truck, Joe was in the stretcher, listing to the left. "Let's go." I reassessed his vital signs and tried to get him to speak. He tried valiantly, but was frustrated and unable to articulate his thoughts. As we sped to the ER, I gave him the news. A wounded World War II vet deserved the truth. "Joe, you are having a stroke. There are treatments available, and we're within the time frame. We can stop the damage. You're not done fighting just yet." His right hand gripped mine fiercely. He made eye contact. Then he closed his eyes. We rode to the hospital in silence, him lost in his thoughts, me hoping I wasn't witnessing his last battle. Reprinted with permission from Fire Engineering. Just once. Rescue 1, respond with ladder 5 to 990 Broad Street at the payphone for a 50-year-old female experiencing chest pain. Rescue 1 responding. Housework had been underway when the tone hit. Me and Rob dropped our mops and made for the apparatus floor. A miniature dust cloud swept through the garage as the overhead door opened, inviting the cold wind into our home. The remains of a late winter snowstorm lingered on the roads of Providence, where salt and sand accumulated, then stuck to our trucks as we plowed through the slush. When the ice melts from the vehicles, a deposit is made on the floor, and we spread it around as we walk to and from the vehicles. The floor is swept daily. We just can't keep up. Spring cleaning is around the corner. That and warmer weather should clean things up. Chest pain at the payphone at 990 Broad Street at 8 in the morning. 99 times out of 100, this is a call for somebody who has been smoking crack all night. It is difficult to not get tunnel vision, but I try to stay objective.
Ladder 5 to fire alarm. Advise rescue. We have a 50-year-old female. Chest pain radiating down her left arm. Diaphoretic. Obtaining vitals. Rescue 1 received. This patient sounded like the 1 out of 100. Ladder 5's crew had obtained vital signs, administered aspirin and oxygen, and had a nitro on board when we arrived on scene. The woman looked like she had just left a PTA meeting in one of the suburbs surrounding Providence. We loaded her into the rescue and continued care, first running an EKG, then starting a line. Vital signs weren't great, 160 over 100 after a nitro with a pulse of 120. The EKG read sinus tach. The patient looked anxious, but her skin was now cool and dry. Ladder 5 went back in service after doing most of my work. Rob and I transported the patient to the ER at Rhode Island Hospital. En route, I found that the patient had been out all night looking for her car, which had been stolen by an acquaintance. I didn't want to ask, but had to. Did you do any drugs last night? I had to smoke some to keep awake. Smoke what? Crack. 100 out of 100. Retraining. We're just people. Sure, we've trained in advanced life-saving techniques. Yes, we have at our disposal tools to be used in life-saving efforts. We have experience, know-how, and that special something that keeps us sane when time and time again all we do isn't enough. We get called when all else has failed. The finality of death is overwhelming when it comes unexpectedly. Most people watch, wishing they knew what to do, but paralyzed by fear. There is no room for second-guessing when a person has stopped breathing. Decisions must be made without thinking, actions carried out automatically, procedures followed, and work to be done. When all we do isn't enough, when a person dies before his time, all we have is the knowledge that we did all we could. Sometimes it is all we have. 2 off-duty nurses took it upon themselves to call the head of emergency medical services in Providence to express their dissatisfaction with 2 of our best EMTs during an incident last week. A man in his 50s died in a restaurant. Our people did everything in their power to save the man's life and took it hard when all they had wasn't enough. The head of emergency medical services placated the nurses, told them he would send the EMTs in question for retraining. I think they learned enough that night. Thank God we have each other. Different views. He lay face down in the street, a stab wound to the back of his head and a bleeding lump on his forehead. A butcher knife reflected the streetlight's glow 3 feet from his head, and a broken golf club rested near his feet. He was conscious, barely. We put some gauze on front and back of his head to stop the bleeding, put him in a C-collar, rolled him onto a spine board, and put him in back of the rescue. As we started an IV and did a secondary assessment, a police officer stuck his head into the back of the rescue. "Has he been drinking?" he asked. "Looks like it," I replied. "Maybe he tripped and fell," suggested the cop. "Maybe he got stabbed in the back of the head with a butcher knife and clubbed on the forehead with a 9-iron," I replied. "It's all in how you look at things, and more importantly, how you report them." Violent crime is down in Providence for the 4th straight year. Relapse. He walked into the Dunkin' Donuts in Olneyville, asked the help to call 911, then collapsed into the puddle his dripping clothing created. He said no more until we arrived. "I got hit in the head with something hard," he explained. "Then they threw me into the river." I did a primary evaluation and didn't see any sign of trauma, no bleeding, no deformities, bumps, or bruises. He told me he had a history of substance abuse, but he had been clean for months. "Can you call my mother?" he asked. We put him into the rescue, stripped off his soaked clothing, and wrapped him in blankets. I took off my coat and cranked up the heat. He gave me his mother's number, and I dialed. She answered on the first ring, sounding exhausted. "Hello, this is Lieutenant Morse with the Providence Fire Department. I have your son in the ambulance. He's not injured, but appears to have been out all night. We're taking him to Rhode Island Hospital for an evaluation." I handed the phone to our patient. He talked for a minute, then was quiet. We got him to the hospital and transferred care in a few minutes.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?